Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Well, welcome to the Talky Bit. So let's talk about hell. despite the fact that for a significant part of human history, hell has been regarded as an actual address, that's very much not mostly what we're going to be considering today. And I should add that this is part one. I don't want to belabor the topic, but even a fast tour of this topic is going to take more than, you know, half an hour. Hell can be thought of in so many different ways. We're going to get into that in more detail shortly. But before we do, I want to establish that from my vantage point, when we're talking about hell, we're talking about a concept, talking about an idea. And like many ideas, this is one that's evolved a lot from ancient times until today, and it's not done evolving. For me, that's a given if I'm talking about an idea. Ideas are not static, they're dynamic. And like most ideas, there is something going on underneath that idea or those ideas that matters a great deal to us as humans. If we didn't care about the underneath part, and I'm not using the underneath language here in any sort of symbolic or locational way, just in the sense of percolating away as part of the process, if we didn't care about the underneath part, we probably wouldn't bother coming up with concepts that address whatever those recurring or percolating things are. Or if we did, whatever concepts we came up with wouldn't tend to be especially enduring, because they wouldn't have any muscle, so to speak. They wouldn't have gravitas or weight or impact to them, and so they would just come and go. And we're all familiar with ideas and notions that come and go. We call them trends. I was reading one of Tolstoy's short stories recently, and in it a character points out that bad ideas This is a paraphrase of a translation, but stay with me. Bad ideas don't become good ones just because they're ancient. I was like, okay, that's fair. And it felt like a good heads up for me, because I'm always sort of watching for what I call enduring ideas, right? So there are some enduring ideas that are truly awful. They haven't become good just because they're sticking around. But they're usually sticking around because they pertain to or touch on or stir something that matters to us as human beings in an ongoing way. And so we continue to kind of regurgitate or evolve or readdress ourselves to these ideas. And I mention that because I think it's important, where we have some agency, to influence the evolution of ideas in constructive directions whenever that option is available to us, or at least to attempt to do that. And there are limits to that, right? But I think if we don't pay attention to that, if we don't do what we can, we're more vulnerable to regarding ideas as givens, as static, as big T truths, for example, when in fact that's, I would say, philosophically never the case, but we could soften it to rarely, for sure. I think, and still, if we think there are things that are immutable. What's going on underneath the history of hell, we could say, is our perennial human wrestling with questions about three big categories. There's a category where we have human questions about justice, balancing the scales, if you will. There's a category where we have questions about what does it look like to live right, so questions about what we would use a word like morality for. And then there's sort of a category, when we're talking about this topic, there's a category that's adjacent to and stirred in with all of that, that is about what we think constitutes the divine, the other, right? And what does that have to do with our questions about justice and morality? So those are sort of the three big baskets that I'm thinking of when I work with these ideas. So questions like, do the bad guys, not a gendered term, but historically it could be, do the bad guys just get away with it in the end? Like, do they really just get off scot-free? Or is there something kind of out there that's going to bring this back into balance? Questions like, what is right and wrong measured against? And by whom? Who's the arbiter of that? Is there a divine being or mystery or energy or something that is involved in all of that? Is there some kind of an external judge or a cosmic parent, some kind of a character in the story that is eventually going to rein in wrongdoing? The working assumption there being that we have some sort of a shared agreement about what constitutes wrongdoing. Which, if we ever wondered if the notions of right and wrong were universal, I think all we need to do is just watch the news once to know how slippery that idea is. Hey, questions of that sort. So, we're in the early going in this particular talky bit, and I expect we can probably already tell that the water is going to get pretty deep. The available tropes here are just innumerable. I almost wrote, the water is going to get pretty hot. But anyway. So in a sort of an unusual twist for this setting at the table, I'm going to tell you in advance sort of where we're headed. I did say that this would be structured as a history, and it will. We're going to move through this chronologically. We're going to start with the ancient roots of these ideas. We're going to consider the influence of some of the ideas from biblical times, that period in history, then into the medieval period, the Reformation, and then some thoughts from modern times. And in part two, we'll try to save ourselves a bit of a moment for speculation about the future as well. And for those of you that are concerned that you'll find this difficult to stay with simply because it's history, I did bring some pictures. So do what I can. Here we go. Oh, I should add that as with any examination of history, this one has a particular perspective, and that perspective leaves out a lot. There's no way around that, right? You got to pick a lens when you're doing this stuff. And in this case, I'm tracing the ideas about hell as they've been most present to and in what we might call, from our contemporary vantage point, what we might call Eurocentric or Western thought, although that's not the part of the planet where the ideas have their roots. And so we'll get to that. So the earliest records that we have that kind of have any sort of enduring nature to the record that contain ideas about hell are no big surprises here. They're from Mesopotamia and the ancient Near East. And time frame is about 2000 to 500 BCE. And I'm going to back up the truck just very briefly. Before this, in terms of the human history, what we have are hunter-gatherer cultures, sort of mini-cultures or tribal cultures. And so those questions about justice and morality and divinity, it's not that those questions weren't being asked or wrestled with, but the way they were being answered was, we might say, hyper-local. They were tribal, right? They were answered the way that tribe answered them. And so we generally don't have, and the traditions were oral, they weren't written, so we don't have a record of those ruminations or those decisions. And in many cases, what we do know would lead us to suspect that they were often, depending on the tribal structure, they were whatever the primary wielder of authority in the tribe said they were. And that could be different for a tribe that was 10 miles away but in a different valley that had nothing to do with tribe A, you know. So just as many as there were. But we get this coalescence in history that happens during this period, 2000 to 500 BCE, because what happens during this period is that people, agriculture basically gets invented, and we start living together instead of being tribal. We start to actually form societies at this point in history. The location, for those who like to put things on their mental map, would be, in present-day terms, this is a region of the earth that covers what would be modern-day Iraq, some parts of Kuwait, Syria, Turkey. It's an area that's boundaried by the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Fertile Crescent. Y'all remember this one from some history class or other, at least by name. And the reason that society coalesces here is because you can grow things here. You can live here. You can farm. And so along with agriculture comes larger communities. Along with larger communities comes the necessity for codifying belief. We have to agree about how we're going to function as a society. And so ideas start to have a form that endures a little bit longer. They start to get written down. And so no surprise, humans are thinking about these big questions, and they write some things down about them. So, One of the cultures that we take a lot from over time from this period in history in this region are the Sumerians. And the Sumerians had two concepts or two words for their concept of what we're going to eventually call hell. And they were called Kur or Urkala. And these were basically their ideas of the underworld. That's sort of how they understood all of this. And in their conception, the underworld was dark and dusty. And that's what we know. It was dark and dusty. I find this stuff all fascinating because where you go, even where societies sort of coalesce, you know, what the temperature of the underworld is has a great deal to do with what the temperature of the overworld is, right? So if you live somewhere where you're battling the cold and you want to think about what a place that is desolate is, it's more cold. If you're battling the heat, it's dry and dusty, right? It's whatever. That's their concept of the underworld. Here's a fascinating sort of evolutionary stream that runs all the way through this consideration. It was dark and dusty, and it was neither a place of reward or punishment. It was just a place, just a dark place. And we need to keep that idea in view because it turns out to be fairly important. This is the same part of history, broadly speaking, this 2,000 to 500 BCE, where the Hebrew people come into the scene as a people. And they have a concept of a place called Sheol. The word itself just means place of the dead. If you find it interesting to have textual locations for ideas, you can find particular references to Sheol in the Hebrew text, the poetry in Psalm 6:5, and in whatever you want to call Ecclesiastes as a literary form, Ecclesiastes 9:10. So particular reference points where this concept shows up in English translation as the word Sheol. And it's interesting in the context of this exploration that Sheol, to the Hebrews, is also morally undifferentiated. It's a lot like the Sumerian idea. It's just somewhere where you go when you die. It's not about good or bad. It's just kind of your new place. That's how it works. So if we were going to diagram the Hebrew understanding of the universe, the cosmos, this is what it looked like, which is kind of fascinating. Like if we were going to turn it into a diagram and said, here's how the universe works vis-a-vis the Earth, where does the rain come from? There must be waters above the firmament. You know, like the logic of it is kind of easily in view. But Sheol is just this place that's underneath the experience that we have of the surface of the earth. Somewhere between the columns that hold up the earth, I guess they were flat earthers, and the firmament that's above the earth, right? So that's sort of the Hebrew picture of Sheol. Now, overlapping a little bit here, during the same period of history, we have ancient Egypt. So this is about 1500 BCE and onwards. And the civilizations that most of us are most familiar with in this part of the world, we still get a lot of our idea shapes from this period of history. Have you ever wondered why organizations seem to feel like they need a CEO? Like you can just actually look pretty much straight to Egypt for that idea shape. Does it work? That's not the point. The point is, where did the idea come from, right? And it's a pyramid. We're still making pyramids. The Egyptians also had a location for the dead. They called it Duat, which the word itself simply means the realm of the dead. It's a bit of a side note, but when I was in Cairo in the early 80s, one of the places that someone pointed out to me was what looked like, to my eyes, like an entire subdivision. It was full of houses, and it was big. It was like to the horizon big. Cairo's a big city. Like population of Canada, big city, you know, and it has had and continues to have a serious housing crisis. At the period when I was there in the early 80s, the population had doubled in about five years, and before the population started to double, they didn't have enough infrastructure and services for the population they had. So you can imagine the mess. So people are living everywhere. So when I saw this sort of subdivision, I'm like, well, what's that? That looks like a lot of housing. Because in the foreground, where I was standing, was a new apartment building that was under construction, and people were living in the construction site. So I'm like, what's that? And they're like, oh, that's the city of the dead. I'm like, well, what do you mean? Well, those are houses for the dead. So I'm like, so people are living in the construction site, and the houses are, so help me, empty, you know, as distinct from occupied by the dead. And they're like, well, yeah, but some living people do live there because they have nowhere to live. But they're not supposed to. So there's this entire city just outside the core of Cairo that's, to my Western way of thinking, empty. But it's the city of the dead. It's the place where the dead go. They need a home. So that still builds on this notion of the realm of the dead. So that's sort of a contemporary take on that. But the ancient Egyptians sort of formalized and documented these ideas in what we now call, the document has a name, we have access to this stuff, it's called the Book of the Dead in English. So this is around 1550 BCE. And the concept as we find it there is when we die, we take a journey through a bunch of obstacles, kind of this obstacle course, during which our soul is, or rather, sorry, our heart is weighed, not our soul. And this is pretty fascinating to me. This language, and I realize there's lots of transmission and translation in the way, but this is still an attempt to get at what might make us behave the way that we do. This language of the heart. Brené Brown, the Atlas of the Heart. I mean, we're still kind of going, how does this work? And what kind of language do we use for why we behave the way that we behave as humans, including, you know, the whole range of our human behavior from, if we're going to think about it in terms of morality, from good to bad. We might still say of someone who's behaving badly, but their heart was in the right place, or but they have a good heart. In the case of the ancient Egyptians, there is a standard against which the heart is measured. Sort of this, it's an early notion of justice as external to the human person and connected to the divine. So there's a particularity about this for the Egyptians that hasn't shown up before this point in history. For the Egyptians, who had lots of gods and goddesses, they had a pantheon. This is connected to a goddess named Maat. And Maat, both the goddess and the concept, and that's important, right? Because our gods are concepts, they're ideas, right? So Maat is a concept as well as a personification. And both the concept and the personification embody the principles of truth, justice, and cosmic harmony. Those are sort of the big pieces that Maat is responsible for as a goddess. It was a feather from her wings that was the gold standard for weighing the heart. If your heart was lighter than the feather, it meant that you were pure and righteous and you got to proceed to the afterlife. If your heart was heavier, it was consumed by a monster named Amit. Amit just means the devourer. And the soul ceases to exist. No torment, just gone. It's over. You don't get to continue to be around as a spirit. So the goddess's job in this mythology is to make sure that the scales used to weigh the heart were balanced. So early Lady Justice, if you will, right? The balancer of the scales of justice. This is Maat's job. And in a bit of an historic harbinger, Maat's principles for order and balance were not just about the afterlife, they were also considered the ethical foundation of Egyptian society. So this is a really important part of the evolution of these ideas. So now we have a divinity who is going to weigh you after death, whose concepts, who comes up with the divinity's concepts? Can we just pause? Who said what Maat believed? Like, we just need to keep this in view all the way through this consideration. All right? But what Maat said was balance, afterlife, was also understood to form the foundation for the good or right life now. And that's a really important connection in all of these ideas. And the authority comes from the goddess. Now, the pantheon for the Egyptians, I don't want to get into the weeds on this, but it was a pyramid, right? So we have a supreme being, Ra, sun god. We have the pantheon. We have the priesthood, so now the humans are in the picture. And the priesthood itself is pyramidic, right? There's authority structure inside the priesthood. And then we have sort of citizenry, people who hold power and position, and we have slaves, right? So there's a pretty clear hierarchy in all of this. I think at this point in history, we can sort of already start to see what's coming. And to some degree, that's the luxury and the danger of history, right? Hindsight is 20/20 and all of that. But also, if we don't learn anything from history, the odds of making the same mistakes again or repeating ourselves at least go up. So we can start to see this connection between divinity, ideas from the divinity or with the divinity's authority about what's right and wrong, forming the foundation, ethical foundation for society. Right? So those big pieces are already starting to be visible to us historically. So onward, inevitably, to the Greeks and the Romans, about 800 to 200 BCE. 8th century BCE, we get Homer's epic, The Odyssey. We're still fascinated by this story to such a degree that as recently as 2024, you know, we had a major movie about it, right? The Return How major is that? Anyway, a Hollywood movie about it. So we just can't seem to shake ourselves loose of this story, which is interesting to me. And one of my personal favorites from sort of recent film history remains O Brother, Where Art Thou, which, you know, has the same story shape. And to me, that just says, you know, a well-shaped story is going to continue to captivate, right? We're going to keep making versions of it because it keeps speaking to us. In any case, in Homer, we find this sort of more explicated or expanded and illustrated notion of the afterlife as this, as Hades, this bleak kind of, it's a shadow world. Didn't explore this at all. Don't know if it's a defensible idea, but whenever I kind of bump into idea, Greek or Roman ideas about Hades, I can't help thinking about Jungian thought and shadows and the connection between those things, right? But this is sort of the concept at this point in history. So the concept of Hades isn't unique to Homer, but he gives us some images that kind of round out the picture. And then a century or so later, and this idea moves pretty fast in terms of history, so, you know, 100 years or so later, we come across the idea of Tartarus. And we find that in terms of reference in Hesiod's work, Theogony. But Tartarus, unlike Hades, is about punishment. It is a pit of punishment. And it's especially there. It's especially there for the Titans. Or, you know, pick your bad guys, right? And in Hesiod's work, for the Titans and for the worst sinners. The really bad people go to Tartarus. So in very broad strokes, and this is all very broad strokes, this is where the paths of good and evil as it pertains to afterlife really start to differentiate from one another. And this is also where the idea that on the bad news side of the story, torment starts to emerge as a theme. Hasn't really been there before then. It's just new address after you're done with this address. Undifferentiated morally. Now it starts to be differentiated morally. And Plato picks that up in The Myth of Air, which is found in Republics. This is about 389 BC. And in that myth, souls are judged after death, all souls, and you go into one or two baskets, punishment or reward, for 1,000 years. So there's like a statute of limitations. So when I was kind of researching this, I was thinking, you know, if you're on the punished side, that statute of limitations is sort of good news, right? There's an end to your torment. But if you're on the good news side, like come on. You know, what's with only 1,000 years? Like, what happens then? Anyway, not going to get into that. Overlapping all of that, at least in terms of time frame, and this is a big piece. We could have spent lots of time on this one. We'll kind of treat it similarly. But in terms of influence, this is huge. Overlapping that chronologically is the influence of Zoroastrianism, which is enormous. There's lots of contemporary scholarship, really significant, substantial contemporary scholarship, exploring the thought that Zoroastrianism might have been a more significant influence on the ideas that Jesus was working with than was previously thought to be the case. There's lots of overlap between Zoroastrian thought and the ideas of Jesus. Now, where the scholarship is kind of like, is where we kind of go, we can really clearly see the influence of Zoroastrian ideas on Judaism. That's quite unambiguous. Jesus was a Jew. How much was Jesus thought, Judaistic thought, and how much was it a reformation of that thought? That's where that stuff kind of gets more finely parsed. But the influence of Zoroastrianism is huge. We can demonstrate that as in terms of history. In any event, what shows up in under our topic here in Zoroastrian thought between about 1,000 and 500 BCE are two ideas which some of us would probably recognize as seeming Christian. And the first is this clearly dualistic cosmology that draws a line between good and evil. So in Zoroastrian thought, this is a clear delineation. And they've got a concept for good, Ahura Mazda, that's good, and Angra Mainyu is evil. And that sort of emerges during this period. And along with those concepts comes an image of something called the Chinvat Bridge. I don't want to speak for anybody else at this point, but I have got an image of a bridge to be crossed, kind of seared into my memory, as central to the question of where I spend eternity. It's a really prevailing image. It's not a concept that I still hold personally, but it's definitely still around. There's also a rather brutal Sunday school course about a door with two sides that poses the question on which side are you to, you know, formative minds and psyches. in a way that I would now say treads either hazardously close to or into the terrain of spiritual abuse, depending on some rather complex variables like context and presentation. But this bridge is fascinating to me, and I think it has a long echo, so I'm going to take a moment with the bridge. Given the influence of Zoroastrianism on Judaism, it's probably no surprise that it also influenced Islam. So those monotheisms are forming at the same time. And they have a similar concept called As-Sirat, which is a bridge over hell that all the believers have to cross on the Day of Judgment. So if these things are starting to sound familiar if you grew up Christian, there's historic reasons why. They didn't just fall out of the sky and land and become Christianity, right? These are people building on ideas that are around them. In both those traditions, Zoroastrianism and Islam, the bridge's appearance, how the bridge behaves, and the ease of crossing it depends on the person's faith and deeds in life. So on the Zoroastrian side of the story, descriptions of the bridge include it being quite dynamic. So it's not a static bridge. It changes its width. It changes its length. It changes its sinuousness, whether it's straight or whether it's twisty, depending on how good or bad your deeds were during your life. And guess what? There's no free pass. Like, if you were bad, the bridge gets harder, right? It's kind of like a double whammy, you know? In some aspects of Islam, descriptions include the bridge being more particular, as fine as a piece of hair, as razor sharp as a sword, hotter than a coal of fire, and extremely slippery, and having hooks and thorns along the sides of the bridge that could hook and snag you and, you know, pull you off the bridge. All in all, these are descriptions of the experience that you'll have if you're a bad person trying to cross the bridge. And they're not especially encouraging. The other side of this religiously, of course, is that those religions also offer a story in which you can avoid having that experience. Right? Right belief and right behavior, according to those religions' code, keep you from having to walk that version of the bridge. In terms of idea shapes, we can, again, sort of see where the trend is headed. If it's good behavior, as outlined by an existing and perpetuated moral code that makes it possible for you to cross the bridge, you're going to be pretty motivated to do and be good. But, and this is also an interesting part of the way these ideas are evolving at this point in history, the motivating forces for you to be good could reasonably be characterized as negative. In other words, you're being motivated to do and be good because of how bad it's going to go for you if you don't. That's what I'd be my negative motivation, right? They're fear-based. And those kinds of motivations tend to produce believers who are fearful and cautious, and for whom being convinced that they're doing the right thing would be a very significant component of feeling confident in their beliefs and actions, because they're trying to avoid torment and punishment, right? It's fear-based. And they would either be concerned for or judgmental of those believing or behaving otherwise, because fear. Right? So we can see the ideas sort of shaping up over history around these aspects. So more on those fronts as the ideas continue to unfold historically. Okay, one more stop for today, and then we'll pick some of this up in part two, where we get into the stuff that I think, if we grew up, you know, around Christianity, we'll be like, oh, okay, I recognize that. But one more stop first. So the next checkpoint is a period that's often known historically as what's called Second Temple Judaism. I won't get into all the background of that, but the period is like 500 BCE to 70 CE. So this crosses over the time where historically we would sort of understand Jesus to have materially been part of the story, right? Beginning of the Christian era. And you can tell from the dates that it crosses over that, but at this point we're not looking at anything that we would call Christian ideas. We'll get to that next time. But first, an idea that shows up in Jesus' teachings but doesn't come from Jesus, and that's the idea of Gehenna. Oh, which already some of us will be like, oh yeah, right? The word itself can simply be a place name, among other things. I've been to Gehenna. Some of you may have also been there, or you've seen it physically. It's a valley. It's just outside of Jerusalem. You can see it from the Temple Mount, which is sort of the most famous address in Jerusalem, if you will. These days, it's kind of pretty, actually, in context. There's lots of trees and rocks and paths and all this kind of stuff. The contemporary name for the address is Wadi al-Rabibi. Despite its appearance and its generally benign reputation today, at this period in history, its reputation isn't great. The oldest historical references for this, and they're from Hebrew texts, Joshua 15 and 18, is to a valley that was a tribal boundary. So Gehenna was a place where this tribe went this far and then it was the next tribe's territory. It's not unusual that a valley would demark something like that. But here's where things get kind of interesting in terms of our study. The next reference to that in Hebrew texts is in 2 Chronicles, which describes this as a site of ritual child sacrifice. Same address, all right? And that's significant because this text is describing what the authors of the text would have understood to be one of the nation Israel's most significant lapses into pagan customs. This is a period in their history where, from the writer's perspective, they blew it. And not, they didn't kind of just like get over into the, you know, onto the rumble strip in the shoulder, like they, or even into the ditch. They went right off the cliff. Like they really got out of their lane in terms of behaving the way that they were understood the divine wanted them to behave. So the king during this period is King Ahaz. And during this period, fire worship is instituted. So not something that the Hebrew God said was okay. And in this particular valley, children were burned alive in fire as sacrifices to the god Molech. And if that intrigues you, there's realms information about why these sorts of places were in valleys. Short version is because the deities that they worshipped were from the underworld. And if you want to get down to it, you can find blueprints of how to make one of these things that include the pipes that would funnel the blood down into the underworld to feed the deity, right? So it's all really quite present and visceral in all of this stuff. Pretty repugnant on the whole. Gehenna shows up again in the book of Daniel. So now we're at about 165 BCE. Alongside, and this is really interesting in terms of the history of if we grew up around these texts at all, alongside the very first mention in the Hebrew texts of people being raised to either everlasting life or to everlasting shame and contempt. So this is the same period historically where those ideas show up for the first time. They're not ever present and immutable. They came from somewhere. And that's important when we think about what we think about these things. So we can see already in the story, we can see the dualism of Zoroastrianism, it's good or bad, starting to make its presence felt by this point, and we can see the notion that the afterlife has two very different possible outcomes coming into focus in terms of human thought about the afterlife. We can also see this sort of logical association that starts to emerge with breaking the rules, with operating outside of the affirmed or agreed upon religious or moral guardrails of a group of people. And how important is this? If you err in your judgment or your choices, you end up in a place of shame and contempt. And in fact, if we take these ideas in the context of their wider story, this particular lapse in judgment is so significant, in terms of Israel's lapse in judgment, it's so significant that even though the next king, Josiah, who's one of the good ones, does the right thing, tears all these places down, as the Hebrew writers would have it, God is so angry about this lapse that he promises to rain down suffering on his own chosen people. Generations of it. So, just so we don't miss it, this is also, in terms of the history of these ideas, is this is where we can start to see this emerging picture of a deity who gets so mad that he'll even harm those he reputedly loves. And yes, I do know that one of the standard explanations for this is that the deity is holy, can't abide what's not holy, etc., etc. I leave it to you to sort through what feels to me like a maze of circular thinking about that, if it interests you to do so. For our purposes today, I want to leave us with some questions. Surprise. Given what we've seen so far, and perhaps what you've been taught beyond this, which I think we'll get into next time, odds are pretty good, what do you imagine? So we're not going to discuss this now, in the interest of time, but I give these to you to just carry away if you wish and think about. What do you imagine we, humans, will come up with next in our quest to make sense of our questions about justice and morality and the divine? Are these even still relevant questions? And if so, if we deem them relevant, what makes them relevant? Why? Why are they still relevant if they are? How do we answer that? How do you answer that for yourself? And if they're not relevant, given their recurring nature in human history, then what sort of notions or questions are we replacing them with? And if we do think we're replacing them with something, are their replacements satisfying? Do they meaningfully address our nagging, recurring concerns about questions like, how will justice be served, for instance? Now, I typically end my talky bits by wishing us all peace. Somehow, that feels a bit odd in context. I actually think it wouldn't be out of line for us to be somewhat disquieted by some of these ideas. I heard somebody put language around disquiet after I had already written this, where I was like, that's what I wanted to try to say. It was the person who was talking about what I mentioned to us earlier about prescribing things like going to the museum or going for walks in nature as healthcare. And she said, she used the phrase troubled generatively, that pair of words, that there is a kind of being stirred up or troubled or disquieted that can point towards something better. But we have to be disquieted to get that something better, to generate that something better, that change. And that's one of the tenets of adult learning generally, right? We have to displace something we think we know if we're going to learn something new. We can't have it another way. We have to make space for a new idea. So that to me feels like, at the end of a talky bit consideration like this, perhaps something like middle ground. So what I want to leave you with, from my perspective here, is my hope that somewhere in the coming days, you will make or find time for some quiet moments within which to muse about this, to think about this. If history doesn't teach us anything else, perhaps it can remind us that change is not only necessary, but also normal. That evolve or die isn't just a bumper sticker idea, but can also be one articulation, and that's important, one articulation, not the articulation, of both how and why we need to keep exploring what we believe. So in the spirit of generatively disquieted peace,